The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
All right. Welcome to a Monday. Monday. But today's not just any Monday. It's a holiday. I've been waiting all day for the mail to show up, and I just realized, oh no, it's Martin Luther King Jr. Day. It is a legal holiday. No mail today. So there's that. Sometimes takes a little bit for things to sink in occasionally. Yes, it is Martin Luther King Jr. Day. And today it is a legal holiday. Although 28 years ago, it was not. It was still a fairly new holiday. And I was working at the time. It was 1994. I was producing the number one morning show in Los Angeles. I was producing the Mark and Brian Show. And this time of year, you know, everyone was just back off the holidays. But I worked. I mean, back then, first of all, we didn't have computers yet. It's the olden days. In fact, the day I left there, it was the beginning of July of 94, is the day that the computers were delivered. So I had worked the holidays, you know, leading up to December. That was our crazy busy time of the year because we put on, seriously, a day before Thanksgiving Day parade. And it was just a huge hysterical event. We would do it. There's a little like a service road that ran between the Los Angeles Sports Arena and the Forum. Not the Forum, I'm sorry, and the Coliseum. Sports Arena, Coliseum, downtown near USC. And there was like a road that ran between the arena and the stadium, the Coliseum. And we would do an actual parade where listeners would submit their ideas for floats and marching bands and you name it. It was a wild event. So that would happen, as the name would suggest, on the day before Thanksgiving. And then the last day before Christmas break, we would do a massive Christmas show. And you know what? I don't have it in my immediate vicinity. I was going to pull up a list of who, you know, I had at the Christmas show that year, but we would have a house band that usually consisted of people like, you know, Leland Sklar, Jim Keltner on bass, Jim Keltner on drums, many of the immediate family who've been on this show, the best session players in the country, probably in the world, as sort of the house band with Scott Page on saxophone, Mark Bonilla on guitar. And then we would have artists come in. Over the years, it was everyone from Kenny Loggins to Mark Cohn to Meatloaf to on and on and on. It was a big deal. We would do it live in the morning from 6 to 10 a.m., with a full audience, and it would broadcast live and the whole thing. So I would produce that, and then Mark and Brian would go on vacation, and I would have to put together best of shows to run through the holidays that I would run. I would physically go in the station at 6 o'clock in the morning for 2 weeks while they're out enjoying vacation, and I would host the show that I produced. And then by the time January 17th rolled around, everyone else was nice and rested and back from vacation, but I was still going. And so back in 1994, for whatever reason, I just on the Friday, I guess it would have been Friday the 14th, because it's the same as it is this year with the 17th on the Monday. That Friday, I walked into my boss's office, had no idea that I was going to do this when I went in there, but I walked in and I said, you know, Monday's a holiday. It wasn't a company holiday for us yet. And we were owned by ABC, Disney. At the time, Disney, I think Disney still owns ABC. But the radio network and all the stations were still under that same heading. So walk in my boss's office. I say, you know, Monday, it's Martin Luther King Day. It's a holiday. I'm taking Monday off. And he said, good, go for it. Enjoy, sleep in. you know me well enough now to know I work through the holidays. It's not a thing, but when I have had enough and I need time off, I need time off. So again, out of character for me, I just proclaimed I'm taking Monday off, and I did. So usually at 4:30 in the morning, I was in the shower because I'd leave my house by before 5 to get into the station. We hit the air at 6. So, but that morning, I did not get up at my usual time. And instead, at 4:30 in the morning, well, all of a sudden, I felt the earth move under my feet. I felt the skies burning down and tumbling down. Seriously, the earth started shaking. I had never been so wakened, you know, shook out of a deep sleep as this day. And I realized very quickly, oh shit, we're having an earthquake. Now, I was living in this adorable apartment in Santa Monica, about a half a block off the beach. If you're familiar with Santa Monica, I was on West Channel Road, just coming out from Santa Monica Canyon, leading to Pacific Coast Highway. And so everything shook. I somehow was lights. There was no electric. When the shaking stopped, I felt around in the dark, grabbed some clothes, and made my way outside. I was living upstairs. It was just a two-story apartment building. So I walk out, and I'm thinking, it felt like it was just us. I thought someone's going to come and save me, obviously, right? And by the time I get outside, I hear car alarms everywhere. You heard a lot of alarms going off. And I go, because, you know, I worked in radio. Even if it's your day off, when there's a major event like an earthquake, you go into work. That's just how it works. So they weren't expecting me there, but I decided I'm going in. I go to open the garage. The garage won't open because it's an electric garage door opener. My car is stuck in the garage because we have no power. And I didn't know anybody who lived around me. I mean, I was a hermit. I still am. But somebody knew who I was, somebody who lived across the street, and came over and said, are you okay? And I said, yeah, but I can't get my car and I need to get into the radio station. He's like, I'll drive you. And so it's a good thing that we took surface streets, because my exit from the Santa Monica freeway, we would go, you know, straight down the freeway, get on in Santa Monica, head west just a couple of miles to La Cienega Boulevard, which is where the radio station was at the time. Well, if you're watching on any of the video streams, I just put up a picture of the freeway. This is at La Cienega, where the freeway collapsed, like a piece of it over the overpass just fell. So we somehow got into the station. The neighbor, whose name I don't even know, dropped me off. I went in and we spent the day, you know, doing news, covering what was going on, because it turned out it wasn't just over my apartment. It was a massive earthquake. And, you know, it was the whole Los Angeles metropolitan area. And so we did the thing. I was there until probably 1 or 2 o'clock. We got off the air at 10, but they're working. And somebody gave me a ride home. I get home, power's still off, but now there's daylight, and I walk outside and I could see all the damage. My kitchen, everything was on the floor. The cabinets emptied out, all the plates were, you know, all over the kitchen floor. Nothing was standing still. And then I walked into the bathroom. Now, I got to tell you, I'd been living in this apartment for maybe a year, maybe two, and it was it's like an Art Deco building. It's still there. On West Channel Road, about a half a mile in from, not even, a few block, about a block in from the beach. The bathroom, it had one of those enclosed tubs, you know, with the sliding doors. And I know what you're thinking, it wasn't the sliding door. But it had a shelf, like a bench, inside the shower. And when I moved in, there was a full-length mirror in there. And it wasn't attached to the wall or anything. It was just leaning against the wall on that bench in the shower. You know where I'm going now. That mirror filled the bottom of the tub, the enclosed tub. The bathtub was filled with shards of this broken full-length mirror. And all I could think, I swear, I fell to the ground when I saw it, because I realized if I hadn't the Friday before walked into my boss's office and said, you know what, I'm taking Monday off, I would have been in that shower when the earthquake hit. I was. Every morning at 4:30, I was in the shower. I would have been dead. I mean, at the very least, I would have been sliced from head to toe with glass. I would not have survived that, because nobody was coming to save me. And that's when I thought, you know, I don't believe in God. I don't believe in anything. But I thought, my mom's up there. I lost my mom when I was, you know, 19. And I thought, that was her. That was her looking out for me, because I should have been dead that day. So anyway, that's my earthquake experience. And every time January 17th rolls around, this is the day that, you know, 28 years ago, I probably should have died. But I'm still here. You never know when you get that little thing that says, go in the boss's office and say, I'm taking Monday off, take Monday off, because it could save your life. Okay. So there's my earthquake story. Yeah, I would have been Swiss cheese. No, I would not have been here. I'm telling you, I would not have been here. So, as the years went by, more and more states, you know, recognized the federal holiday, that Martin Luther King Jr. Day did become a day that all companies gave their employees off. Well, so if you work in media, you know, all bets are off. But most companies, bank, no mail delivery, no banks are open today. So it is Martin Luther King Jr. Day. So let's go back. Well, actually, this wasn't from Martin Luther King Jr. Day, but let's go back anyway about what is the, it's 2022. Let's go back 9 years. Shall we? It was August. It was August of 2013. We were coming up on the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, of Martin Luther, the 50th, and I'm still feeling aftershock, the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington and Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, right? And I was, the week before that, I was guest hosting the Randy Rhoads Show. Her show was syndicated through Premier Radio. And so I'm filling in for her, and it was just a couple of days before the big 50th anniversary. And I, you know, I thought, well, let me give it a shot. And sure enough, I got an interview with Martin Luther King III. I thought, who better to talk to on as we're approaching the 50th anniversary of that seminal speech? And the way things go, you know, I looked everywhere for that interview. I mean, I don't have all the shows that I did when I filled in for Randy. But what I did that day is I did pull a few clips. So I spoke with him. It was August 23rd, 2013, 5 days before the 50th anniversary of the march. And I asked him if he had any memories of that day 50 years earlier, realizing that he's right around my age, and I was just a baby then. And so here's how he answered that question.
I do not remember that particular day at 5 years old. What I remember is that my mom and dad, when they came home, they were very, very excited.
I'll bet.
There was a lot of jubilation because it and they were really exhilarated because the demonstration was so positive. And it was really, if you think about it, in 1963, America was very segregated. So the fact that blacks and whites and younger people and older folks came and children came together, America came together in 1963. It was such an uplifting period at that particular time.
So interesting. So I wanted to know more about Martin Luther King Jr. as a man and what Martin III's memories were of him. So, you know, rather than go for the question that you would think someone would ask, I asked him about the personal side of his dad, things that we didn't know about him that we should.
Number one, Dad was a great athlete. He used to come home and toss the football and toss the baseball, and every now and then we would shoot basketball hoops. But he was not tall in stature. He was only about 5'7", but he could jump very high. Number two, he was an avid swimmer. So we used to go to the YMCA to swim with him from at least once a week. He would get exercise at the YMCA. And number three, he was very humorous.
He was funny.
America.
Who knew?
Saw the serious side of Dad. But and as all dads, I mean, he was just a tremendously loving father. And, you know, I take experiences from that. I actually, my wife and I have a five-year-old daughter that has joined us. She's up here in Washington. And so she'll be experiencing the 50th anniversary and already has an understanding to some degree of her own family legacy.
Well, that daughter, that five-year-old daughter, is now 13. We saw her, I want to say it was the day of the Women's March, give an empowered, short but powerful, not really a speech, but she addressed everyone and was eloquent and amazing. She is the future. Anyway, she's there today. They're marching today. There was a march on Washington. Let me, more than 100 civil rights groups participated in this march on Washington today, led by Martin Luther King III and the family, urging Democrats to pass expanded voting rights protection legislation. And apparently, Martin came out today blasting Kyrsten Sinema, as is deserved. Let me play one more clip from that interview because it's all I have. I think this pretty much explains what the question was itself.
The issue of being judged by the color of your skin is still very prevalent, as opposed to being judged by the content of one's character. I think that we're moving there, but it's clear to me we still have work to do. That does not mean that our society is not a wonderful society. But I think this march, this 50th anniversary, I'll say the one in 63 was about jobs and freedom.
Mm-hmm.
In 2013, the march is around jobs, justice, and freedom. And so there's an additional issue added. But the fact of the matter is there are many in our nation who are still not working, and specifically youngsters between the ages of 18 and 35, there are significantly large numbers of youngsters who are not able to find jobs in our country. And so that's why we're focusing on those issues.
So that's what they were focusing on in 2013. Today it's the filibuster. And you wouldn't think, going back 50 years, that the filibuster was that big a deal. Oh, but it was. Martin Luther King Jr., Martin III's dad, participated in a televised press conference back in 1963. You can find it online. It's on YouTube. I'm obviously not going to play the whole thing. But there was some weird regulations around it that it couldn't be played in the U.S. for 12 years. Well, the 12 years is up. But one of the things in that press conference, whoops, I guess we'll find out who this is. Hi, who's this?
Happy Martin Luther King birthday.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Who's this?
This is Linwood from Charlottesville, Virginia.
Hey, Linwood. Okay, make it quick because I'm in the middle of something and I got a guest coming up. So I, you know, but you called.
No problem.
I always said I'll take your call.
Well, the reason for my call today is, you know, this is a great day, a celebration.
Mm-hmm.
We're still at war as a country.
More so than we have been in a long time.
Anything,
yeah.
Not to sound radical, but like I was telling Randy, the only way you're going to get voting the Section 5 part back on the books is if something dramatic happens. This country doesn't respond to peace. It responds to war.
Okay, well, all right. Lynn, I don't have time for this today, but I don't advocate for war, and I'm hoping we can get it done. We had it for many, many years, and it didn't take war. You know, we used to have a Congress that would vote 98-0 in the Senate to reaffirm the Voting Rights Act. But we're talking about the filibuster right now. And this was Martin Luther King in that press conference directly addressing the filibuster.
The president's program were incorporated, or such portions of it, it would lend himself to this. How would you feel about submitting this to a vote of the people of the United States who have never really had an opportunity to express themselves in this area?
Well, this would certainly be all right with me because I think the vast majority of people in the United States would vote favorably for such a bill. I think the tragedy is that we have a Congress with a Senate that has a minority of misguided senators who will use the filibuster to keep the majority of people from even voting. They won't let the majority of senators vote.
Isn't that interesting?
And certainly they wouldn't want the majority of people to vote because they know they do not represent the majority of the American people. In fact, they represent in their own states a very small minority.
They represent in their states a very small minority. Martin Luther King there could be talking about Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, the more things change. Yeah. The thing is, in between then and now, we had unanimous agreement every time the Voting Rights Act would come back up for reaffirmment, they'd pass it unanimously until now, because we are in a weird place. And it's because of this, you know, I want to play something for you. It's not related to Martin Luther King, to today's holiday, or anything else, but it is. Because this weekend, we saw a synagogue in Texas in a hostage situation. A terrorist took four people hostage, including the rabbi, and it was a tense, like, 11 hours. And thankfully, everyone got out alive except for the hostage taker, the terrorist. But last night, I'm watching Mehdi Hasan. He's like the one person on MSNBC. There's a handful that I like still on MSNBC, and he's at the top of the list. I hope he gets, you know, either gets takeover for Rachel or Brian Williams or whatever. He deserves a full-time show because now he's relegated to Peacock and The Choice, and they hide them. Anyway, I watched this segment last night, and I meant to hold it and pause it so David could hear it, and I forgot. And then I saw it posted this morning, and I was so glad they posted it. So let me take 2 minutes and play this for you. Again, this is Mehdi Hasan on MSNBC last night talking about what unfolded on Saturday.
What happened yesterday was an outrage. Synagogues shouldn't be places where Jewish American worshippers have to be afraid. Synagogues shouldn't be places that require armed guards. And yet in 2018, we saw the Pittsburgh synagogue shooting, what was described then as the single biggest massacre of Jews in American history, 11 dead. In 2019, we saw the Poway synagogue shooting, one Jewish woman killed, three more worshippers injured. The far-right shooter there was just sentenced last month to life in prison. Now, you'd have thought that the start of the pandemic and the lockdowns would have led to a big reduction in attacks on Jews in public places. But no, 2020 was the third highest year on record for anti-Semitic incidents in America. Because sadly, anti-Semitism is a vile, resilient, and long-standing virus in our communities.
Yep.
There's a reason it's called the oldest hatred. As journalist Yair Rosenberg pointed out on Twitter, one thing people do not realize is that Jews are just 2% of the U.S. population and 0.2% of the world's population.
0.2%.
It actually takes a lot of effort to even find us. But every year in Western countries, including America, Jews are the number one target of anti-religious hate crimes. That is a scandal. The hostage taker last night reportedly wanted to free a Pakistani Muslim prisoner in Texas who was convicted a few years back of trying to kill an American soldier in Afghanistan. But what has that got to do with four Jewish Americans in a Texas synagogue? Why take them hostage?
Look, good question.
Whether it's on the brown Muslim far right or the white Christian far right, attributing superpowers to Jews, claiming they are behind all of the world's evils, responsible for all of the world's ills, is both insane and deeply dangerous. And so all of us have a role to play in pushing back against these anti-Semitic tropes and bigoted rhetoric that inevitably fuel anti-Jewish violence and hate crimes. In October 2018, in the wake of the Pittsburgh synagogue massacre, the rabbi who was held hostage in Texas last night wrote a Facebook post in which he said, quote, "Too many times in Jewish history, we faced tragedy without love or support. Too many times to count, we were left to pick up the pieces of tragedy and destruction. Believe me, the love and support matters. It is something that we should all be able to expect of each other. Let me say to Rabbi Charlie Citron Walker and to all of my Jewish viewers watching at home tonight, you are not alone. We have your back. And in this moment of fear, hate, and violence, you can count on the rest of us."
Wow. Wow. That is Mehdi Hasan. And you know what? That deserves a round of applause. And it shouldn't. It shouldn't. But it does. Because this is the climate in which we're living right now, a climate of hate. And that's an openly, you know, a publicly Muslim man, proclaiming his solidarity with the Jews who are being persecuted just like Muslims are and have been, especially since 2001. We need more of that and less of the noise that comes from Fox and those other places. Good on him. I thought that was just wonderful and needed. It was something that needed to be said, and he said it, and I appreciate it. Okay, so let me tell you, our guest today is the guest that we were supposed to have Friday. I hope. He should be here in about 5 minutes. John Hall is a musician. He was in the band. Oh, and sure enough, just like magic, as I start talking about him, he appears. So let me try to get our shot set up as I tell you a little bit about our guest. So John Hall was in a band called Orleans. You certainly know at least a few of their songs. Dance With Me was one of the big hits. And of course, when I'm trying to think about it, I don't think about it. But you do know the songs. And then, wait, hold on, John, I got to get your shot set up. So let me, I'll keep introing you until I can figure out our the camera angles and all that stuff. And then I will bring you in and I'll let you tell us a little more. But anyway, so then John Hall had a very successful music career. In the mid-70s, he had these hits with Orleans. In the late 70s, he was one of the co-founders of Muse. Muse was Musicians United for Safe Energy. And I actually was in Florida at the time, so I didn't get to go see these shows live. But when the movie came out, oh my God, I was right there. The No Nukes movie is what I'm talking about. And turns out that one of my favorite moments of the whole thing, which was a concert with so many of my favorite artists, from Jackson Browne to Bonnie Raitt to Bruce Springsteen to, you know, the Doobie Brothers to James Taylor and Carly Simon and Graham Nash, and it went on and on and on. One of my most favorite moments of that film, of the album that I wore out, was the song Power, which is one of John Hall's songs. John, it's so nice to meet you. Welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us today.
Hi, Nicole. Thanks so much for asking me to be here, and it's good to see you and hear you.
Well, good to see you and hear you, too. That's the nice thing about technology is now we get to see you, too. So let's just talk about No Nukes for a moment, because I started on that. Here we are. It is 79 to... It's like 40-something years, almost 50. 43. Wow. Time flies, I guess, is all we could say. But the things you were singing about then, the reason for the Muse to be formed is, well, still relevant. We haven't fixed any of it, have we?
Well, we're moving in that direction. We didn't move as fast as we had all hoped. A thing I'm really proud about with the song Power, well, one of the things is that it starts out, just give me the warm power of the sun.
Right.
You know, steady flow of the waterfall, spirit of living things, yep. Which, by the way, was a veiled reference to biomass conversion and as they return to clay. Uh-huh. And the rest of the power of the wind. And so, you know, it's all about renewable energy. And we find ourselves now, all these years later, having not done that, starting seriously back then, you know, in a situation where once again, certain interests are talking about nuclear, or people are talking about nuclear as a fixed or a one of the solutions to climate change. And I'm sorry to take the other side, but I think
please do.
Well, okay. Well, you know, it's just money going down a bad, you know. Good money after bad, down a rabbit hole. When nuclear power was first, the commercial use of it was first proposed after the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the Atomic Energy Commission at the time, forerunner to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, decided that they would promote this, and there was a lot of money put into it. And we were told that it would be so cheap, it would be free.
Yeah.
That it would be too cheap to meter, quote unquote.
Right.
And obviously, it's not. Every nuclear plant in this country is run over budget and been dangerous in a bunch of ways and unreliable in many cases. There's a lot of talk about small modular nukes now that might be safer, but the problem is nobody's even made a prototype. There's nothing running that we can see that says it works, whereas we know if you put those same billions of dollars into solar panels or wind power, they'll work.
Absolutely.
And you can have them next year. You know, you don't have to wait for the 10-year period or so that it takes to,
right,
to site and install a nuclear plant. So,
and you don't have to worry about what you're going to do with the waste, with the water, with all the after effects.
Right. Not to mention the fact that the nuclear fuel cycle is not carbon free.
Right.
Plenty of diesel fuel burnt during the mining of uranium, and there's tons of power used enriching it, and there's power and fossil fuels used transporting it to the plants when the plant goes down for refueling, or if there's something wrong, which happens pretty frequently, that the plant has to shut down because there's a repair needed or something. They use diesel generators for backup power, and then when it's when the fuel assembly is used up, they has to be cooled forever.
Right.
Right now, being forever in the pond on the site of the generating station, and it takes energy to do that, to circulate the water and so on. It's not the clean fix that we're being told. That it is, but it's also, we don't have just two choices.
That's very true.
Burning fossil fuels, or we better use nuclear.
Right, and you're right. We are moving away from nuclear, and that there's nothing. There are no new plants coming online, at least here. However, there are plants still in operation that were deemed obsolete years ago that should be taken offline. Right.
Well, probably so. I mean, you know, there's a debate about that because of if a plant can be, I mean, I wish they would tighten the maintenance standards for them so that there couldn't be corners cut. Mm-hmm. It's a problem when you have a for-profit utility running it because, of course, they want the shareholders to be able to get more dividends. And that's when you can get into trouble with an old plant or any plant. But yeah, a lot of these plants are past their design life. If they were designed to last, you know, 30 years or 40 or 50 years, you don't really want to keep them running past that, because the more radiation they have internally, the more the pipes and the valves and all the different parts are damaged and weakened. So it's and corrosion sets in and so on. But it's a big topic. The thing that I never hear enough about lately, anyway, is conservation. It's just trying to be more efficient, which is the low-hanging fruit. It doesn't cost anything. In fact, it saves us money.
Right.
And just if everybody switched over to LED lighting, if everybody drove the most efficient car they could get, if the government bought people electric vehicles, at least for all their around-town driving, you know, there are so many things like, you know, weather stripping and insulation. We talked about this in the 70s.
Right.
If you could hire a civilian conservation corps to weather strip apartment buildings in big cities, you know, tenements, old apartment buildings that don't have storm windows. I used to live in one on the Lower East Side. You know, it's probably still there.
Uh-huh.
And probably still hasn't been insulated.
Probably not. So John Hall, was it your activism, your concern about the planet, that made you venture into politics?
Well, it was my concern about my community, you know, planet being, you know,
part of it.
By extension, the planet. You know, the first thing that happened when I was living near Woodstock, New York, in the town of Saugerties in upstate New York. Mm-hmm. My next-door neighbor was a Vietnam vet, came over with a stack of papers one day and said, do you know about this nuclear plant that the state power authority is trying to build 6 miles away? And I said, no. And he said, well, read this. And he was the kind of guy, when he said, read something, I read it. And we wound up going to, he and I wound up going to hearings of the NRC and New York State Power Authority back when you could smoke in the meetings and the guys were commissioners were all smoking pipes or cigars or cigarettes and literally had their wingtips up on the table.
Uh-huh.
while the citizens asked questions and made comments, and you know, I dutifully filled out a question on an index card and passed it forward. But partway through the proceeding, my neighbor said, Jan Estwood is his name, said from the back of the hall, he called out, "What are you going to do with the waste?" And somebody said, "Sorry, you have to fill out a card, sir." And he said, "Card my ass, you're killing my kids."
I did that at a town hall meeting with my congressman, and I got arrested. I'm just saying. Yeah. But
it's good to have somebody to make me look moderate. You
know, well, you know, John Hall, I got to tell you. So you did serve two terms in Congress representing New York's 19th congressional district. And Howie Klein says hello.
Oh, good.
Howie Klein is my regular Thursday guest. And these days, you know, he runs the Blue America PAC. And he said you were the very first candidate the Blue America endorsed in a congressional run.
Well, that's really nice. I started actually running for office at the county level.
Right.
The Ulster County Legislature. I ran and served one term there, 2-year term. And I was trying to stop a giant incinerator and solid waste facility from being built in Saugerties. And then we stopped that. And then I did a few other things that I thought were good. And then went back to full-time music and private life. Ran for school board when my daughter was in high school, and her freshman, sophomore, and junior years, they were on austerity budgets because the board didn't draw up a budget that the voters would pass. And I was determined sure her senior year would be fully funded with, you know, smaller class sizes and new computers and new tennis balls for the tennis team. You know, it's just, there's so many things that get lost when you go on austerity. So I won, and I served I was reelected. I served 1 3-year term, part of another. I was elected president to the board by my fellow trustees, and it was interesting because I'm a union member. I'm a musicians union, and AFTRA, American Federation of Television and Radio.
Me too.
A member, but you know about that.
Yes, and, I do.
But so the first time I ran, I had the teachers union support. And the second time I ran, they opposed me. And I won more votes the second time than I did the first time. Although I'm happy to say when I ran for Congress, they endorsed me again.
Oh, good.
But there are parochial issues in every little district. And there was one that they were very angry with me about. But, you know, when you're president of the board or when you're superintendent, which is not an elected position, when you're superintendent, then, you know, you have to know where the bodies are buried and where the money's buried and where, you know, you get into a situation where all of a sudden there's a big expenditure nobody predicted. You have to be able to pay for it somehow.
Sure.
And so it's difficult because you want to, no matter what decision you make, somebody's going to be angry with you.
So John Hall, when you were in Congress, you were there, what, 2008 to 11, basically, right? Those 4 years.
I was elected in 06 and reelected in 08.
Right. So, and things were contentious back then, but nothing like they are now. When you watch what's going on there, when you see what happened January 6th, and you see the divisions in Congress now, is there any similarity between then and now?
Well, there's a little bit, not that much, but I was there when Congressman Joe Wilson in North Carolina shouted, "You lie," in a silent moment during Barack Obama's
I remember that. I was watching.
And yeah, I mean, that was kind of the beginning of it that I, as far as I was aware. And the fact that he raised $500,000 online that night was, you know, a lot of people paid attention to that. And too many people decided they would do the same thing to raise more money. So, but I also, probably my biggest accomplishment was a veterans claims bill. I was appointed by Speaker Pelosi, the chair of the Subcommittee on Veterans Disabilities, and I helped write. I was the main author of, and my committee drew up a bill called the Veterans Claims Modernization Act of 2008, which did some really good things for vets who were coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan at the time with all kinds of serious traumatic brain injuries and PTSD, and limbs blown off, and just, you know, IED explosion injuries, among other things. And it passed the House and the Senate unanimously. Every Republican and every Democrat voted yes.
Wow.
And President George W. Bush signed it into law and called it good government. And I was, he could have blown me over with a feather. I basically ran against George W. Bush in 06. But, you know, there's still the possibility, I think, that that kind of common ground can be found. But we just have to really look harder for it. And I think both parties have to look harder for it.
Without a doubt. So did you... you served two terms in Congress. John Hall is our guest. You did you leave voluntarily, or were you just you didn't win re-election the third time?
No, I lost in 2010. I ran five elections: school board and county legislature and Congress. Well, I should say I won five times and lost the sixth. But you know, I was told before the vote on the Affordable Care Act that this was a vote many of us would lose our seats over. Not that it's my seat. It was never my seat. It's the people's seat in that district. But you know, they came after it was. It passed.
Well, it's 2010, and that was you know, when the Democrats got routed. It was the first midterm after Obama got elected, right?
Right. It was the first midterm after Citizens United.
Well, that too. We're coming up on the 12th anniversary of that in a couple of days, by the way. That Friday is the anniversary of Citizens United, the ruling by the FCC, by the Supreme Court, that said corporations are people, basically, and speech is money, or money is speech, which is...
Corporations have the same free speech rights as individual.
Unbelievable. Citizens. And on that same day, by the way, that year... That the same day that the Supreme Court ruled on Citizens United, Air America Radio went off the air. I was working there at the time. It was the only outlet for progressive voices on the airwaves back then when Rush Limbaugh dominated radio everywhere. And so it was a two-shot, you know, smack to the head on the 21st of January in 2010. So that, you know, that a lot happened that year. It was a bad year. to put it lightly.
It wound up being okay for me. I mean, I certainly didn't want to lose. Mm-hmm. I was trying my best to win that election and to win the discussion about the Affordable Care Act. And I think that by now it's, you know, people have figured out there's more good about that bill than there is bad. Most people still don't know, because it hasn't been covered enough, that the Affordable Care Act kicked every member of the House and Senate off of the federal employees' health plan and required to buy their health insurance on the exchange where their constituents were able to buy.
Good, as it should be.
You know, I said when I was doing around the districts, the five counties I represented, when I was doing town hall meetings about this, people would say, "Well, why can't we have you have what you have? Why can't we have the health insurance you have?"
You do.
And I said, "Well, that's what's going to happen. I'm not going to vote for it unless I have the same opportunities for insurance that you do." And so that's what's in the bill.
Awesome.
And but because it passed by one vote, I remember Nancy Pelosi telling me in a caucus, a closed door, you know, Democratic caucus one time, I had a minute to talk to her about pharmaceutical advertising on TV, how I thought, you know, we shouldn't allow it. My doctors say, you know, why should I have people coming in here asking me for the little purple pill when I went to medical school to learn what to prescribe for their issues? And, you know, a lot of the time it's not what they're asking for, and they'll go find another doctor and get what they're asking for. And so I was talking to Nancy about that, and she said, and also the price of advertising those things on TV goes straight on the cost.
Oh, of course. Of course.
So and she said to me, well, you're right. You're right. And I agree with you. And the people in my district in San Francisco would agree with you. But if we pass this bill, we're going to pass it by one vote. Uh-huh. So far, you know, we don't have the broadcasters against us or the actors union or, you know, the people who produced commercials and all that. If you, you know, if you go for this, maybe the maybe your friends who are also in AFTRA and are acting in these commercials or writing music or playing instruments for the music on these commercials, and the broadcast lobby will all of a sudden decide that they're against the bill and start running ads against it, making calls on it. We won't get anything. So I said, well, maybe we should pass it and then try to get an amendment doing that. She said, that's what I'm thinking. She's so sharp.
Never got the amendment, though, unfortunately.
Well, you know, not yet.
Well, I don't know that anyone's trying. They should. But we have, you know, a lot of other pressing issues. John Hall is our guest. I want to move forward to today because you have a new album out. I love the title of it. It's called Reclaiming My Time. I know it's a phrase that's been around, but I think Katie Porter really popularized it in the last session of Congress because she uses it so effectively. And I don't know if you can tell behind me, I've got a bunch of artwork. This is my pandemic silver lining. I started doing artwork. And what I have up there are things that I call flutterbys. They're actually butterflies, but I think that's a stupid name for the creature that has nothing to do with butter, but they do flutter by when they fly. Right. And so that's why I've always called them flutterbys. Anyway, so I made those up because one of the songs featured on the new album is called Save the Monarch. And you want to tell us a little bit about it? You're joined by Dar Williams, who I just adore, on this song, and we're going to play it in a moment. So why don't you tell us about this song?
Okay, well, Save the Monarch is written as a hymn. You know, it's kind of a prayer for endangered species, and the monarch butterflies, the first one that's mentioned, that's a pretty good-looking one over your left shoulder. Looks kind of like a monarch.
Yeah.
There you go. But it was written to sound like God Save the Queen. You know, at first I wanted people to think, oh, Hall's writing a thing about the royals now, you know, but it's not that. It's the queen of the honeybees.
Uh-huh.
It's the dark butterfly. It's the king condor. It's all these endangered species that we're pushing toward or over the brink, and how we're all part of that same fabric. My little brother was a Jesuit priest. I was brought up in a very devout Catholic family. And regardless of how I or what I practice now, I was taught to be a good steward. That was one of the things that I learned as a kid. You know, and I think that that's something we all need to do. And for selfish reasons, too. It's not just because we think there was some ancient religious requirement put on us or request made of us or scriptural one. But my granddaughter's going to be living in this ecosystem after I'm gone.
Yep.
And I never want her to say, granddad didn't do enough. Why didn't he do more? And so it's important. And Dar and I have done a lot of environmental benefit concerts together and work. We both run the board of Clearwater, Hudson River Sloop Clearwater. And so she was also my neighbor in Hudson Valley for a long time. So, and I was her representative.
Awesome. Well, I love Dar Williams. Back in my music radio days in L.A., I did a morning show on a big AAA station, an adult alternative station. We played Dar's music, and she was on tour with Joan Baez, and we used to do these remotes in the morning between 6 and 10 a.m. from Starbucks. Well, one morning, Joan and Dar came to a Starbucks and performed for hundreds of listeners who packed into this tiny Starbucks. She's the real deal. She's just awesome. When I saw she was on the song, I got excited, and the song is great. So let's play it now. It's John Hall. The album is Reclaiming My Time, and this is Save the Monarch. Here we go.
Save the monarch, the monarch butterfly, save the fire arrives, you in whom we trust, save them from us.
Save the poachers on the loose, and the wildflowers from the poison that we use. Eternal and just.
Save them, save them, save them from us.
Feathers or fleas,
and all the mere creatures living in the coral reef, you in whom we trust,
eternal and just.
Just beautiful. Save the Monarch, John Hall, with some help from Dar Williams there. And just magnificent. The photography in the video is gorgeous. Who did that?
His name is Rob Arthur. Rob is a keyboard player who's played with Peter Frampton for, I don't know, 20 years or so. And also is a whiz with video, with all still and video photography. And he started, when the pandemic hit, he started developing this new job. He started with doing videos for Peter, and he wound up doing them for the Doobie Brothers. And if you saw that Blackwater or Listen to the Music in Isolation, and he did them for he did one for Frampton with Let It Rain with Sammy Hagar and Mike McDonald and the Doobie Brothers and Mick Fleetwood playing drums and so on. He could probably just do video now if he wanted to.
That was gorgeous and beautiful. And
And you have an exclusive, I believe, Nicole. I think that's the first time this video has been shown
publicly. Awesome. So, well, thank you for that. I'm honored. Maybe
everybody else will have it in the next day or two.
Okay.
But anyway,
That's I'm really terrific.
Proud. I'm really proud. It's probably as important to as important a statement as I have to make. So.
Well, it is. And the thing about, you know, the butterflies, the monarch, which they've said are disappearing, we need those if we want to keep eating, right? They are crucial to our ecosystem, aren't they? For food.
Yeah. Yeah. As are the denizens of the coral reefs.
Absolutely. And the bees.
You know, one of the things that's gotten, another thing that's gotten relatively little notice is that, the carbon dioxide being absorbed and carbon monoxide being absorbed into the ocean is turning into carbolic or carbonic acid, and the pH of the ocean is changing. And if it gets too acidic, shellfish won't be able to grow their shells and keep them. And krill, being at the bottom of the food chain, kind of, I mean, if it starts there and works its way up, there's so much protein that depends on the bigger fish eating the smaller fish, and then the really big fish eating them, and so on. And if that all crashes because of the acidification of the oceans, we are going to be in a serious problem for nutrition. Already on the planet, there's a shortage of it. But I think most of the people on this earth, certainly the ones who live near coasts, are eating a lot of seafood for protein.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of thing you don't think of. Like, there's so many different facets to climate change and you know, to are trying to switch over to renewable energy as quickly as possible. But that's one that needs more talking about.
Without a doubt. And actually, that's a perfect lead-in to this, because I do want to play Power before the hour ends. So let's do it. This is a recording from one of the concerts, one of the Muse concerts in New York. I think everyone watching and listening will recognize a lot of the people there. You'll see John, a much younger John Hall, and friends. Here we go.
We'd like to sing the John Hall, Johanna Hall song for you to become sort of the song of our movement.
Just give me the warm power of the sun. Give me the steady flow of a waterfall. Give me the spirit of living things as they return to clay. Just give me the restless power of the wind. Give me the comforting glow.
Descendants in time, so much to gain, so much to lose.
Every one of us has to choose. Just give me the warm power of the sun. Give me the steady flow of the waterfall. Give me the spirit of living things as they return to clay. Give me the restless power of the wind.
just amazing. John Hall, Jackson Browne, Bonnie Raitt, Carly Simon, Graham Nash, and a cast of thousands. I get chills still every time I hear that song, and it's a good thing my microphone was down because I was singing along loudly. Love that song, John Hall. Well, it is just so brilliant.
Thank you. I should say that not every song on my record, Reclaiming My Time, is political in this way. Somebody asked if I was a topical songwriter, and I said, well, every song's got a topic. Dance With You is a topic.
Right.
Still Dance The One.
Still The One. That's the one I couldn't think of. Still The One.
But there's songs in this record, like there's one kind of a New Orleans barrel house piano thing called It's All Up and Down From Here, and which somebody told me when I was celebrating an anniversary of sobriety. And it's true. You know, you keep thinking, well, some people like me keep thinking that you know, life, when you're in a bad space, like it's going to be like this forever. You know, my life's in the toilet, but it always comes up. And when you're at the top, you make a mistake if you think it's going to stay there, because there's always another dip coming.
Always, it seems. Well, I just had the album cover up there. The album's called Reclaiming My Time. It's available in the usual places, I'm guessing, yes? All right. John, thank you so much. This has been a real treat to talk with you. And thank you for continuing to make great music and for being out there. With COVID, it's complicated everything. Are you out on tour? Are you going back out on the road?
I've been playing with Orleans since my partner Larry Hoppen passed away in 2012. Oh. I've been playing with the band again. And we were playing actually this Friday in Mount Pleasant, Michigan, a casino, the Soaring Eagle Casino.
Okay.
Way up in northern Michigan. And I had knee surgery about 4 weeks ago, so I'm not flying. I'm having a friend drive me up there and back so I can get out and walk around and exercise my leg often enough. But it's there's always another show coming up. We from starting in mid-March, we have a lot of Orleans concerts around the country. So looking forward to that.
Great. And do you still keep in touch with the old Muse gang from Jackson and Bonnie to Harvey Wasserman and the rest of them?
Pretty well. They're all pretty much West Coast people.
You're right. You're still in New York.
I don't have the let's meet at the coffee shop
right.
opportunity.
Gotcha.
But yes, I'm in good touch with Jackson. My dearest friend, Andrea Zahn, plays with James Taylor for ages.
I just saw the tour, the Jackson James. Oh, it was wonderful. I'm down here in South Florida, so they were here a few weeks ago. I've seen two shows, and I love live music. It's my thing. But it's been, you know, over 2 years. So I saw them, and I saw Todd Rundgren. And now I'm back in isolation again because, you know, it's Omicron.
So I did get a chance to see Jackson and see James and stay in touch with Bonnie pretty regularly. So, and I'm looking forward to hopefully the disappearance of this virus at some point soon. It would happen quicker if everybody got vaccinated.
No kidding.
And wore a mask. But anyway.
Without a doubt.
We'll deal with whatever it is.
Yep.
It is kind of Darwinian selection, I'm afraid. It's the Darwin effect, I think it's called.
Yeah, I think so.
People who are not careful seem to be the ones getting it the most. So
that's a shame.
Anyway,
John Hall, find him at johnhallmusic.com. That's the website. And you're also on Facebook and Instagram, johnhall.music, I believe. Thank you so much. This has been a real treat, a real pleasure for me. I couldn't have enjoyed this anymore. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Nicole.
Thank you.
And hope to talk to you again sometime in the future.
I would love that. Thanks so much. Bye. You take care.
Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye. John Hall, everybody. And that's it. With that, we come to the end of another program. But see, music on Mondays. Good idea, right? All right. I will leave you with the news. Tomorrow, we're going to talk Davos. Talk about a switch. And then the week will continue because it does. So thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. I'll see you tomorrow. I will leave you with the news, though, because there is some of that going on. All right. Bye-bye. You're still the one. That's our song lyric for the day. Or take all your atomic poison power away, A.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Monday is Martin Luther King Jr. Day, a national holiday honoring the civil rights leader who won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1964 for advocating racial equality and social justice. More than 100 civil rights groups participating in a march on Washington today, led by the family of the late Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., urging Democrats to pass expanded voting rights protection legislation. Just last week, President Biden delivered a powerful speech calling on Senate Democrats to change the chamber's filibuster rule to prevent Republicans from blocking the legislation. Two key obstacles: conservative corporate Democrats, Senators Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin, said that they oppose the rule change, thereby depriving Democrats of the votes they would need to counter voting restrictions approved by Republican-controlled state legislatures. Martin Luther King III, the son of the late civil rights leader, who would have turned 93 on Saturday, said the stakes could not be higher to protect and expand his father's legacy. Despite opposition by Manchin and Sinema, the Senate is expected to take up the voting legislation on Tuesday. An FBI hostage rescue team stormed a Texas synagogue Saturday night, ending an almost 11-hour standoff with a hostage taker who claimed to have a bomb. The suspect was a 44-year-old British citizen who will not be named in this news update. He was shot and killed. Four people, including the congregation's rabbi, were held hostage at Congregation Beth Israel in Colleyville, Texas. The suspect released one of the hostages around 5 in the afternoon. The other three emerged after the FBI raid, which started at around 10 p.m. The hostage taker reportedly claimed to be the brother of Pakistani neuroscientist Aifa Siddiqui, who's serving an 86-year prison sentence for shooting at soldiers and FBI agents, the shooter demanding that she be released. Well, Siddiqui's family said through a lawyer that the hostage taker was not Siddiqui's brother and that the family condemned the heinous synagogue attack. The suspect's brother said he was mentally ill and that the family tried to help defuse the situation, but there was, quote, nothing we could have said to him or done that would have convinced him to surrender. Well, Virginia has a new governor. Glenn Youngkin was sworn in as Virginia's 74th governor on Saturday. One of his first executive orders banned, quote, the use of divisive concepts, including critical race theory in public education. What? Youngkin takes office with a divided state government. Democrats hold a 3-seat majority in the Senate. Republicans control the Assembly 52-48. Winsome Sears was sworn in as Virginia's first woman of color to be lieutenant governor. Jason Mayorkas, also a Republican, took office as the Commonwealth's first Hispanic attorney general. The week begins with more than 50 million people under winter weather alerts across the eastern U.S. Freezing rain, ice, and snow have left more than 180,000 people without power. Roads are a mess in states like South Carolina and, yes, Virginia, where hazardous conditions have caused several crashes. Air travel has been snarled by the wintry conditions, with more than 3,000 U.S. flights canceled on Sunday and more than 1,200 flights canceled as of Monday morning. Things were weird here in Florida, too. The panhandle saw some snow. We in southeast Florida were surprised by tornado warnings on Sunday, the first time I've ever seen that. But southwest Florida, two tornadoes touched down, destroying at least 28 homes in Lee County on Sunday. Parents of young children, please listen. Healthcare professionals are ramping up efforts to inform parents that unvaccinated children face increased vulnerability to COVID-19. While early data indicates that Omicron appears to cause less severe symptoms and leads to fewer hospitalizations, its rapid spread indicates that more children are likely to become infected. For the week ending January 6th, nearly 600,000 child COVID-19 cases were reported nationwide. That's a 78% increase from the week before. Schools are struggling to remain open for in-person learning, but a lack of money is not the problem. Much of the $190 billion that Congress authorized for schools earlier in the pandemic still hasn't been used in most states. Less than 20% of the federal money had been spent by the end of November.
And Surgeon General Dr. Vivek Murthy is warning that the record-setting wave of COVID-19 cases fueled by Omicron has not yet peaked in the U.S. He added that hospitalizations and deaths could continue to rise for the next few weeks, with many hospitals overwhelmed with a nationwide record of COVID-19 patients. He did add a bit of good news, saying that the surge of new infections has leveled off or dropped in the Northeast, particularly in New York City and New Jersey, saying, quote, "The challenge is that the entire country is not moving at the same pace. We shouldn't expect a national peak in the coming days." And he added that the next few weeks will be tough. The 7-day average of new cases was more than 800,000 over the weekend. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is fully listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.